All right, now back to Titus chapter 2 now. Remember, this is a chapter, as we have said, which is for people who have been to the school of grace. And we draw that thought from chapter 2 and verse 12. In a world in which we tend to want to segment everybody in terms of age, race, gender, or economic status, which is, if you watch the political campaigns of our current year, it's so thought-provoking how in a world where equality is so much stressed and valued, so much of our public life is directed at the segmented views of humanity. It is a refreshing thought to look at the picture for the church that we have here in Titus chapter 2 and think about older men and older women and younger women and younger men and all of those in between, and you find out that these people have relationships and contact with each other, and that they are intended in the picture that we have here first to be their best selves, to be themselves. All of these statements, we don't have the older men addressed about the older women or younger women or younger men. We have the older men addressed about whom? The older men. In other words, the idea is that we in the church, we are expected, by being our best selves, to build relationships with everyone else, with people from other stations in their lives, and to therefore be a blessing to one another on our way to heaven. That's why we're living in a culture that is so different from ours. What the Lord wants to happen in the church doesn't happen everywhere, and it doesn't happen naturally. I don't want for us to miss the wonder of this, that such a thing would be possible. For this ideal to exist, I think is interesting. The older men, we've learned, were to be sober-minded, dignified, self-controlled, sound in faith, in love, and in steadfastness. Older women were to be reverent in behavior, not slanderers or slaves to much wine. They are to teach what is good, and so to train the young women, and we've studied through most of verse 4, to love their husbands and children. We pointed out that the word for love here is not the love of will, where you decide to be committed no matter how you might feel about them. This is the word for warm affection toward a husband or to children. To be self-controlled, this is an important word to this whole context. It has been used with regard to older men already, I think, because it's such a contrast to the culture on Crete, where people were lazy gluttons. This sensible self-control or temperateness is important. The younger women are to be taught to be pure, to be taught how to manage a household, to be taught to be kind. At the end of verse 5, there is no way to overstress the importance of this learning kindness. How in the world can kindness be taught in a world where parents, for example, are to set standards and to use good judgment and even to discipline? Kindness cannot all mean letting everybody have their own way at all times. A kind mother does not just say to the kids, "Y'all do whatever you want to, and I'm going to be your best friend." And kindness will involve not only the sensitivity to what's going on in the lives of other family members, it will involve the words which are said, the tone in which the words are said. It will involve small deeds that are intended to be thoughtful blessings in the lives of family members. How is kindness to be taught? How can kindness be taught from one person to another?
By example.
Yeah. By example? What kind of example? How would you go about teaching someone to be kind?
By being kind yourself.
All right.
I think that's what she means by example is if they're watching the way that I do things for other people or whatever, then my actions should be the example that they're wanting. If you can't sit down and say, this is how you treat people, and then you go treat people some other way.
So if I use the idea of mentoring that we sometimes hear today, there would be not only the engaging and doing kind things, but sometimes there would be come with me and help me be this blessing to someone else. In other words, children might learn kindness by watching their parents do kind things for other people, going with them and helping them do that. But an older woman, a more experienced Christian woman, might help a younger Christian woman learn kindness in this way as well. The word for kind is the same as the word for good in some cases in the New Testament. So we're talking about the doing of good towards someone else. Now, look at the next phrase that's here. To be submissive, we're still talking about to be here, to be submissive to their own husbands. I doubt whether there is any quality of Christian character which is more misunderstood and sometimes even more maligned in our culture today as this one here. To be in subjection to or to be submissive to their own husbands. One time I was, I'd been asked to come somewhere and do a little workshop for Bible class teachers. And in one of the sessions I decided to use this chapter in Titus 2 because I believe this is a passage that indicates the desirability of having settings for people at different stages in their lives to be able to learn how to function as Christians where they are in that stage of their lives. And we were working our way through this passage, and we just read through this, I noticed a lady who got up and left the room, and the preacher for the congregation told me afterward that she had real issues with this term because she had been abused by a cruel husband at some stage in her life. And you can see from that there are individuals who have been left to with the idea that this term means somehow simply making yourself a doormat for whatever cruelty might come along. That's not what this word teaches. Let's explore it for a little bit here. In the first place, the fact that someone can be taught to be submissive tells you what about the individual who is going to do this. What does the fact that someone can be addressed and be taught to be submissive, what does that tell you about submission or being in subjection?
It's not a personal characteristic.
Okay, that it's not a natural one. It's something that we learn. All right, what else, Eddie?
I think we have to go back to the second verse and realize to whom he's speaking with, that the men are to be a certain way, and then their wives will be submissive to them.
Okay.
Of course, in another verse, it tells the men to love their wives as Christ loved the church.
Yeah, in Ephesians 5. So one of the things that you guys are doing is trying to put this in an overall context of Scripture, right? Where this is only talking to the individual young lady here in this passage. There are other passages that talk to husbands about what they have to be. This passage assumes that the readers are going to be faithful Christians, people who have been trained by grace, and each of these have their own responsibilities and so forth. That's true.
There has to be a willingness.
All right, Jan is getting to what I had in mind when I asked the question here. The fact that this is something where the individual can be taught to do this would tell us that this is a voluntary action on the part of a responsible and free Christian woman. Do you see what I'm getting at? This is not something that one person imposes upon another. This is something which the individual chooses to do because she is a Christian. It is a voluntary action of a dignified person. Does that make sense? You see why I'm saying that? I want to point out another thing about this. Notice a little bit later in this same chapter, down at verse 9, it speaks to servants or the household slaves who lived in an economic system in which slaves were numerous. This is something that is not the racial slavery that we have known in the history of our country. People could be slaves either because they grew up in a family which made its living in that way, or because they had been conquered in some kind of a military campaign, or because they had sold themselves into slavery through debt, or because they had entered this bond servant type of a role in order to make a living. There were, in other words, they had this role by various means. What are Christian slaves told to be in verse 9? What's the first thing it says to them?
Be subject to their own master.
All right, to be subject, and you can't see it in the English version, but it's the same word, submissive. All right, does this mean, now listen carefully to me, does this mean that Christian wives have the same role as slaves, or does it mean that a voluntary submission is a quality of Christian character that spread out on a wider basis? Which? The latter is how this has to be understood. Now, I want to point out to you that this is in Ephesians 5:21. It says that we are to be to submit to one another out of reverence for Christ. And it's talking to all of the members of the Lord's family in that passage. So what I'm getting at is when children are addressed, they're to be in subjection to their parents. They're to have this attitude here of voluntary submission to authority. Now, why is this an element of Christian character? There is a reason.
It implies all the way up to Christ.
All right. All right.
Any person can be submissive, and once you learn that, then it just works.
And all of us have to volunteers to submission in some way or another because we're Christian. Now, Linda pointed out that the church submits to Christ, Ephesians 5, verse 22, 23, right along in there. That's true. But what did Christ do toward the Father? So what we're talking about here is really the Spirit of Christ worked out in practical relationships and in life, right? Now, That is a voluntary thing, which is a part of the Christian spirit that's worked out in relationships, and this is a thing that is what I notice in the letters of the New Testament, which address Christian relationships. One of the odd things is that the apostles who write these letters start their instruction to the persons in the low that are considered societally to be in the position of least power. They address them first: children, then parents; wives, then husbands; husbands, then the Lord, and so forth. Why do you suppose the New Testament goes about it in this way? It speaks first to the position, the person in the position that society would regard as the least powerful position.
Christ said, if you want to be the greatest, you be the least.
That's right. I think that's it. We sing it all the time. What is it that leads home? The way of the cross leads home. And this is the idea here that is modeled in Christian behavior, or Christian conduct. The term means to arrange under. So the idea is to teach the younger wife how to... You notice all the responsibilities that she has here in the family, how to be submissive to their own husbands. All right, explain to me, what does this mean? And I'm going to give you a hint. I don't believe that kindness and submission are to be ever thought of apart from each other. I don't think it's any accident the way in which the order of this comes in verse 5. I know that we talk about it. Somebody has to be in authority. Someone has to have the say-so. The other one has to go along. Listen, the kind of husband who is described in verse 1 and who will be described in verse 6... would never simply declare his authoritarian will and demand that all the rest of the family do it regardless of what they thought. Shauna?
Well, we did a study. I wish Ruth Lund was here. We did a study in the women's Bible class in studying about the submission and everything. And it just talks so much about like the husband being selfless.
Yep.
And that a husband's love is also selfless. When making decisions, he will serve his wife's needs before his own.
All right.
She responds by serving him.
All right, that's very well said. Submission means looking, and that's why I attach it to kindness, looking to the need of the other persons and submitting yourself to that need. And you think about the way what Christ has done for us as the model for that. He thought of what we needed, and he did his Father's will with regard to that. Jan?
It goes along with what she was saying, but I was thinking a while ago, a few years ago when we were, Larry and I were still doing those married couple weekends out at Abbey Hall, and one year they gave us a little thing, and the plaque said, all it said was, what can I do to make you happy?
Yep.
And we talked all weekend about if I would get up every morning and think, what could I do to make him happy? And he was thinking the very same thing. We wouldn't have to worry.
Yeah, and of course, that is an ideal to shoot for that at least I fall short of. I think all of us do because we see it. And that's the ideal that we live for. There are many people who are Christians who live in much less than ideal situations. 1 Peter 3 talks about Christian women who maybe have a husband who doesn't share their faith and how they go about this. And the idea is still, you do out of your dignity, you do what you can to meet the need of the other person. That is the idea, and it's an important idea, I think. Anyone else with something you want to add to this? Yes, Linda.
And also, there's very apparent times when the breakdown on either the male or the female will cause a horrible situation.
Yes.
Someone demands you have to submit to me, and someone says, I'm not ever going to submit to you. You have stalemate, standoff, and it's definitely not a Christian attitude.
There are
situations where it's unbearable.
There's situations where tragedy even occurs out of that kind of stalemate, and unbelievable hurt enters into the lives of good people very often in that way, Todd.
Well, there again, I think it's still trying to get into the perspective of context, and the world wants to define that word as being weak.
Yes.
And then having a mindset of weakness. And that's truly not the context of what it is, because then they want to determine that as that's what a Christian is too.
Yes.
Is somebody that way. And but then that's why the world is trying to get Christians to submit to what their definition of marriage should be. I mean, it even goes into further context that way, and that's exactly the opposite.
I'm glad you pointed out that the debate is not over the idea of being submissive or not being submissive. It's over what do we submit to and why.
Yeah.
And there is, if you think about Linda's point just a moment ago and what I said earlier about why is the one who society thinks is in the weaker position authority-wise, why is that person addressed first? And the point is the Christian has the strength to go first. You think about that. The Christian has the strength to look to the need of the other person first, and that's a huge challenge. If you consider the culture in which fulfill yourself is the rallying cry of all things, Barney.
Is this a pretty far removal from what was taught under the old law? If you go back to Genesis chapter 3, and having the Garden of Eden, and woman's, if you want to say punishment, part of that in that verse was obedient to their husband.
Yeah, part of the consequences.
And, yeah, part of the consequences. I mean, it almost makes it look like that was part of the punishment.
It gets portrayed in that way. I think this term is removed from that to some degree. Part of the difficulty of trying to deal with this matter is how different what we mean is from the culture's assumptions that Todd just mentioned about this word. This is a term of wonderful strength in the Bible. Part of the difficulty is also the different ways in which this idea gets applied in the family situation and then in the church meeting situation. Now, let me illustrate what I'm getting at. There are three different settings in which this argument gets made in the New Testament. One is here in Ephesians 5 and 1 Peter 3, where family relationships are the issue that are being considered. And in those issues, what the writers will say to Christian women is, look, you go about thinking of what you can do to meet to be a blessing to your husband. That's your husband's. That will be the idea. Then, in a passage like 1 Corinthians 11, the first part of the chapter, Paul makes an argument resulting from order of creation. And he, in that section, he seems to be dealing with the challenge of Christian conduct within a culture, especially where how we dress, or in that case, he's dealing with some of their customs about coverings for their heads or veils for the faces and so forth, and he deals with that. But he argues based on the order of creation. And then in passages like 1 Timothy 2, first 12, 13 verses of that passage, when he deals the assembly of the church, the meeting of the church, this passage in 1 Corinthians 14 and so forth, he seems to base his argument on what Barney was just mentioning, that God has assigned leadership responsibility partly because of who sinned first, is his reasoning. Now, it's sometimes a hard argument to get our minds around, but those matters deal with leadership roles among God's people, and where that's the issue, then what Barney mentioned, I think, is brought up. The argument used in Titus chapter 2 is more based on the grace of Christ, the example of Christ, what he has done, and how to be a blessing in the family setting. I think that's an important part of this. Our time has gotten way past us here. I want to mention two or three things quickly before we finish. In verse six, notice that he says one thing about younger men. What is it? Urge these younger men. Exhort these younger men. What? Why are they given one thing to do?
Because they're given more in the next two verses.
Oh, they are, but Titus especially Titus as a teacher in the next couple of verses.
That's the hardest thing for them to do.
All right. Because this one thing has something to do with every single area of life. There is no area of life where self-control, and the term again means sober-minded, sensible, what are some of the other synonyms that are used? How it gets translated? Anybody? Sober, it said? Or?
Self-control,
okay. That's the idea. This has to do with learning to be the master of oneself. And it is so interesting how this is but another side of this same word here, isn't it? If being submissive is, then is it being self-controlled in some way, learning to control your own desires and to submit them to the appropriateness of the situation, to the standard of Christ, to the need of the people around you? Isn't that, that's part of what we're getting at, aren't we? Think about the fact that this word is used of the young men in verse 6, of the young women in verse 5, of the older men in verse 2, and it was used of church leaders in chapter 1 and verse 8. Why is it that this comes up so many times in this little letter? It's opposite of human nature. It is opposite of the culture in which they live, and it is so important. There is no human relationship that can be successful without the practicing of self-control. You watch, I'm having the pleasure now of watching my children try to teach their children self-control. And they... You want to sit back and grin and say, now you know. Now you know. But why food is not thrown in the floor, and why we can't just take a toy from somebody else, and why we can't just do whatever we want whenever we want to do it. You know, that's a part of maturing, and that's part of the thing here that he's talking about. Verse 7. Now to Titus, and I believe that we're meant to think probably that Titus is a younger man himself. The connection here goes with this. Show yourself in all respects, notice that, to be a model of good works. Good works are used in this book not in terms of church programs, but in terms of how we behave in our family relationships or in our dealings with other people like this. And that's an interesting point to me. We'll discuss it more when we get down to the first part of chapter 3. But the ways in which a teacher like Titus can, the good works are going to apply to him. And your teaching, show what? And by the way, I think this is maybe both the manner in which he teaches, but also of the message that he teaches. What does this show?
Purity.
All right, purity is the way that version translated. How else do you see the first term there translated? What?
Doctrine.
All right. The
soundness.
Soundness. Doctrine. The DSV uses the word integrity. And then dignity. We're going to need to come back to that word next week. We got about half as far as I meant for us to today. But let me just point this out to you. You realize that what we're talking about here will be the determining factor in the health of a congregation. No programs can substitute for different age groups of people being capable of relating to each other like this in their relations with each other and in their families. That this is more important than any program that we can talk about. And if you'll think about how much of the time our enemy uses these things to disrupt the life of God's people. Not false doctrine, but these things, then you see the practical nature of this, I believe. And we'll pursue the thought farther. I appreciate your patience and with us as we try to dig into what some of these words mean. You guys all have a good week.